You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Yeah, I am a scientist. Yeah, I am a scientist. Yeah, I am a scientist. We gotta live on science alone.
Welcome to Unbiased Science, where we bring scientific method to the madness. We're your hosts, Dr. Jessica Steyer.
And Dr. Andrea Love.
And this week, we are tackling a topic that has been in the works for months because we have received, I don't know, thousands of messages at this point, Andrea. The topic of PFAS and endocrine disruptors and just broadly the endocrine system. And so to tackle this highly technical and complex topic, we've brought on two experts who we'll introduce in just a moment, but we're very excited to be finally tackling this topic. So it gives me great pleasure to introduce our first guest, Dr. Eve Bloomgarden. Dr. Eve Bloomgarden is a board-certified endocrinologist in the Chicagoland area, co-founder and the chief operating officer of the Illinois Medical Professionals Action Collaborative Team, IMPACT, and Chief Development Officer of Women in Medicine, a 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to closing the gender gap in healthcare. Love that. Dr. Bloomgarden received her medical degree from New York University and completed residency and fellowship training at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Bloomgarden's clinical expertise is in the diagnosis and management of thyroid disorders and thyroid cancer, as well as pituitary and adrenal disorders. Dr. Bloomgarden speaks and teaches on the role of healthcare professionals in countering misinformation and disinformation using social media. IMPACT recently published an article on social media misinformation in the New England Journal of Medicine, which we will absolutely link to in our show notes. You can follow her on Twitter at EveBMD, and you can follow IMPACT on Twitter and Instagram at IMPACT4HC. Andrea, would you like to introduce our next guest?
I would. And so on the other side of the coin, we have an expert toxicologist who is one of the foremost leaders in all things PFAS. And so I am very thrilled to introduce Dr. Christopher Weiss. Dr. Christopher Weiss is certified in general toxicology and is the principal science advisor and CEO of Weiss Toxicology, which is based out of Bethesda, Maryland. Prior to founding his own company, Dr. Weiss served as the senior science advisor and toxicology liaison to the director of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, that's NIEHS, and the National Toxicology Program, where he represented NIH, the National Institutes of Health, on national and international committees, task forces, and ad hoc working groups related to toxicology and environmental toxicology. While he was at NIEHS, Chris conducted research and represented NIEHS on many national and international committees, including service as the president of the American Board of Toxicology. Prior to his work at NIEHS, Dr. Weiss served as the forensic toxicologist for the EPA's National Enforcement Investigation Center, that's the NEIC in Denver, where he supported civil and criminal investigations for the EPA, as well as providing scientific support to dozens of federal Superfund actions and environmental emergencies throughout the U.S. He's worked extensively with the World Health Organization and a variety of other environmental health teams throughout his career. So now that he is no longer a government employee, we can pick his brain and utilize all of his decades of experience in discussing this very important topic. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And is this the first time we've had four people on the pod, Andrea?
I think so, yes. This is a first, but we wanted to do this very complex and nuanced topic that has kind of blown up on social media. Due diligence, both from a clinical perspective, a biological perspective, and a toxicological perspective.
So with that, let's kick things off. Eve, maybe you can help just provide a little foundational information on the endocrine system. What are we talking about? What are the chemicals and organs involved, bodily processes? Can you help set the stage a little bit?
Absolutely. So, you know, I think I appreciate the intro. This is a large topic because it truly is. And you know, I think it's important to kind of define some terms to start. And, you know, number one being, okay, well, what is the endocrine system? And basically, the endocrine system is it's a signaling system in the body where hormones made by glands are the primary communicators in terms of development, reproductive, thyroid, you know, all of the different aspects of the body. And so what endocrinology is basically it's the way that our body kind of communicates and signals in order for physiologic processes to occur. And it's very complicated. And so when we talk about endocrine disrupting, what we're really talking about are synthetic or chemical molecules, let's say, substances that can act through the endocrine system, meaning they can either mimic the signaling that normal endocrine processes use to help with physiology, or they can block that property. They can impact kind of any organ system in the body. We typically think of endocrine glands like thyroid gland, pituitary gland, adrenal glands, pancreas, reproductive organs like testes or ovaries. There's a large complex, you know, system behind it.
Yeah. And Eve, something that, you know, I always try and explain kind of from the high level is that, you know, the endocrine system is producing these signaling molecules, these hormones, which can be steroid or fat-based, lipid-based, or protein-based. And these are like these long-term or long-distance signals that can travel from wherever they're produced at these glands or organs and travel throughout the whole body and have these kind of broad systemic effects. So it's understandable that people want to know what are we exposed to in our world, whether they're natural things or synthetic, that can interfere with either in a positive manner or, you know, which is, or in a negative manner, which is obviously of more interest to people. And that's where this context of endocrine disruptors comes in. And so a lot of these substances, whether again they're natural from food sources or plants or things like that, or they're man-made substances, they're often called hormonally active, right? Because they're mimicking or they're antagonizing some of these communication junctions that are required by the endocrine system in order for it to do its job.
Absolutely. And to make it even more complicated, hormones can interact with each other. Various hormones have very different actions and consequences depending on stage of life or stage of development, even impacting, you know, in utero. So, you know, there's a lot of kind of complications and interactions that go into understanding the impact of endocrinology and of hormones in general. And as such, it is also, it becomes a victim of things like misinformation or fear-mongering we hear a lot. You know, I always say before COVID, endocrine was like the number one, you know, source of medical misinformation, which is how I got interested in the area of misinformation. But it's really true. There's a lot it's complicated, it's nuanced, and it's exquisitely sensitive to very, very small changes in the local environment and internal and external. And I'm sure we're going to come back to this natural, you know, versus synthetic question, but I think that was an important thing to introduce as well.
So would it help bring the topic to life? Can we give some examples of endocrine disruptors? And maybe that could be a nice segue into PFAS, which I feel like sort of the star of the show here.
That's going to be the spotlight. But maybe Chris, you can kind of kick us off starting with maybe some synthetic endocrine disruptors, and maybe a little bit of background for some of them.
Sure. I'd be glad to do that, Andrea. There are so many endocrine disruptors, and I think it's important what Eve said about the fact that there are very natural endocrine disruptors, and we live in a world where in many ways surrounded by these things. So understanding them is important. Fearing them is not necessarily of importance at all. But some of the things that are endocrine disruptors known to cause endocrine disruption that are synthetic are a number of pesticides. Aldrin and dieldrin have now been banned because of their endocrine disruption characteristics. Brominated flame retardants, these were for years sprayed on furniture and carpets and other materials in it with the intent of suppressing fire. It turns out they weren't so good at that anyway, but nonetheless, they bind to thyroid hormones and can disturb that whole axis. And Eve may expand on the importance of the thyroid in endocrine disruption. DDT, still not used in this country anymore. It's been banned for some time, but it is still used in Africa and parts of developing countries to suppress. It's a wonderful tool for suppressing mosquitoes and the diseases that are carried by insects. But that fortunately has been banned in this country. Diethylstilbestrol, and Eve, you can expand on that as a clinician. This is a very, probably one of the early recognized endocrine disruptors that did cause serious problems and really brought attention to the importance of understanding how these things work and what role they play in our own endocrine systems. And then, of course, we'll talk a little bit about PFAS. As the conversation goes on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, those are some of the key ones that come to mind. And Chris, I think before I want to pass it over to Eve to talk about some of the clinical implications, especially about
DES.
Yeah. But before I get to DES, I'm blaming that on all of my vaccines I got last night. But you made a really good point, Chris, is that a lot of these are no longer used. They're banned in the United States. DDT, we actually did a post on DEET, which is an insect repellent, very different from DDT, and got a lot of heat that was misplaced. But again, a lot of these things were recognized to have potential health impacts, not even just to humans, but also animals, particularly in the case of DDT.
Very important.
And were removed. And it also brings up the context of the dose making the poison. And we're going to get much more into that with regard to PFAS. But maybe, Eve, you can talk a little bit about some of the recognized health impacts from a clinical perspective of some of these legacy chemicals.
Sure. I think DES is a really good example because it was used in, I think, from 1940 to 1970 or so, and given to pregnant women as a means to prevent abortion or miscarriage and premature labor. It did not really do that, but what it did lead to was an increased risk of a rare type of vaginal cancer. And also we saw exposure during pregnancy kind of led to all of these adverse effects in female children, again, including vaginal and breast cancer, reproductive tract dysfunction, menstrual irregularities. Furthermore, the grandchildren of women exposed to DES had an increased risk of other ovarian and menstrual irregularities as well. And so what this really talks about is this transgenerational impact of disrupting and interfering with the endocrine system. And we've seen this in other examples as well. We see that, the daughters and the granddaughters are carrying these risks decades and decades later. And it really points to, again, like the nuances of the way that hormones are regulated and the timing and the amount of exposure matters. There's a window in which, there's no such thing as too much or too little in terms of hormones. It's all about homeostasis appropriate to the stage of development and to what process the body is attempting to, go through, starting from before you're born. And so DES is a big one. The other one we saw was in Michigan, the PBB, and I have trouble saying what that really stands for, but the incident in which a flame retardant exposure in the 1970s led to transgenerational effects in terms of notable issues with the animals in real time, but we're still measuring things down the line, 2 to 3 generations later. And I think what this says is, we need to really understand what we're doing and what we're exposing ourselves and our kids and our grandkids and our communities to. Those are like the big examples that I think we can really take in terms of the impact that really lasts much, much longer than just the moment. In terms of other, there are lots of different endocrine disruptors that impact not just the reproductive systems or estrogen or androgen, but there's evidence of neurotoxicities. There's evidence of obesity and increased risks of type 1 and type 2 diabetes. There's a lot of evidence now accumulating about the interference in thyroid function leading to congenital hypothyroidism and or earlier onset of hypothyroidism with changes that are measurable in the mom all the way down through the baby and further on in life. And so these are things where the evidence is just continuing to accumulate since awareness really started about this 20, 30 years ago.
Certainly cause for concern, you know, warranted attention on a lot of these things, especially because there is a history of finding out after the fact, after something was in use, that there are long-term health impacts. But I think it's also important for people to understand that, you know, the endocrine system, just like most of our organ systems, are very dynamic. And Eve, you made a great point about a lot of times it's about the timing of exposure to a certain hormone or a certain similar mimic like an endocrine disruptor. And not all endocrine disrupting chemicals are harmful, right? So there are actually some that actually seem to have a positive impact. So I don't know, maybe Chris or Eve, you could talk about some of the phytoestrogens in soy products, perhaps?
Yeah, there's been a lot of discussion, of course, about soy. Soy is such an important protein for the worldwide. It's simple and easy to grow, and it provides a very high-quality protein. There were lots of discussion about a component of soy called isoflavones, and one in particular, genistein. It does have biological effects. They have biological activity. All food arguably has biological activity, but these isoflavones have been tested extensively with very little evidence of endocrine disruption, with the exception of genistein, which seems actually to reduce the concentration of blood sugar in blood and reduces various diseases associated with that, like diabetes, to an extent. Recently, keeping in mind that the report was done by the soy industry, there was a very extensive review of the literature, a critical review of the literature that they did. It's a very, very good study, very, very comprehensive, showing that there's really very little evidence indicating that isoflavones are problematic. And as we continue with our discussion, there's a balance between using soy as an example. The importance of high-quality protein, particularly in developing nations, is so important. You trade that off with, you know, some biological activity, and using soy as an example, but there are many, many examples like that. Pesticides, you know, some pesticides are life-saving.
Absolutely,
Yet they're bioactive. You might not want them in your water.
Right.
But they're really, in many cases, in many situations, they're essential.
Soy gets a lot of heat, right? Because these isoflavones, they structurally are very similar to an estrogen hormone, specifically 17-beta estradiol. And so a lot of people that spread misinformation about the endocrine system have said, oh, well, eating soy is going to lead to increased estrogen levels. It's going to mess with your sperm quality. It's going to impact your ovulation. It's going to cause infertility. And as Chris, you just noticed, there's actually no evidence that even though this is structurally very similar to an estrogen-like hormone, it doesn't actually cause negative impacts to your hormones.
And I was just going to add on TikTok, and yes, that's such a wonderful source of information. There's a whole group of people who are saying that, men shouldn't drink soy milk because they'll develop breasts. And so can we just talk just for a minute before we turn to PFAS, sort of debunking this misconception about soy? Eve, were you going to say something?
So, I mean, I think it comes back to endocrine principles, which is that, you know, the endocrine system is uniquely designed to maintain homeostasis. And it is, you know, it's not just about the level or amount of the hormone in circulating in the system or stored in your fat cells or wherever it may be stored or produced. It's about the ability of that hormone to act on the target cell. And so, you know, we have, endocrine hormones or hormones, I guess that's kind of redundant, act through receptors. And so, and the receptors activating, blocking, or changing the amount produced or available on the surface of the cell is also finely regulated. And there are tons of redundant systems to inactivate the pathways, even if the receptor is inappropriately activated. So what that means is it's not just about, you know, if you expose yourself to too much estrogen, you're going to develop breast tissue. Yes, that is true if that estrogen is allowed to act through the pathways that, you know, exist. But there are lots of mechanisms for, you know, in thyroid function, for example, you know, we have deiodinase enzymes that basically regulate the amount of active thyroid hormone in the nucleus of each cell. And it's a fine-tuned system to maintain homeostasis. Your body does the same thing in terms of estrogen conversion, you know, either estrogen conversion to activity or the ability of testosterone to be aromatized into estrogen. All of these things are very finely tuned. So it's not as simple as exposure equals consequence, with the caveat that sometimes it is, right? So if you overwhelm the nuanced system and the balance of receptors and activity, you can get a clinical syndrome. So we define kind of endocrine disease as too much or too little of a hormone at a certain period of time. So, you know, you can have growth hormone excess, which is acromegaly, or you can have growth hormone deficiency, which is, you know, leads to a variety of opposite complications. You can have glucocorticoid excess leading to something like Cushing's, or you can have adrenal insufficiency, which is the exact opposite. You can have hyper or hypothyroidism. And so there's always a spectrum of phenotypes based on the amount of levels. And these, the levels we're talking about are very, very small, which I think is relevant to this discussion. You know, we measure things in parts per million, parts per billion. And so, you know, allowing your body's own homeostatic mechanisms to auto-regulate your hormones is always ideal. But we have really good understandings of how to manage endocrine disease. And, you know, when things go awry, we're actually very good at fixing or replacing a hormone or blocking the effect of the hormone. I mean, that's kind of the nature of how we treat endocrine disorders. And so the challenge is really when you either don't know someone's exposed or when it's in a critical window of time, like puberty or development, you know, thyroid hormones we can easily replace, or, you know, if you have too much, we can fix that too, but not in a developing fetus if we don't have a biomarker or an ability to know what's going on. And I think that's where the big knowledge gap is existing right now, is just how many endocrine disruptors are out there and how exactly they work, and how do we really take that to you know, how do we understand the impact to population or to a community as opposed to an individual.
Yeah. And I think, you know, Eve, you made a couple of really great points. I think the first is people do not give our body and organ systems enough credit for being very tightly regulated and controlling changes or pressures from external factors in regulating that. I think another thing is that a lot of people automatically assume that if you consume something, it is automatically available by the relevant cells and the relevant receptors and all of that. And that's something that we hear a lot about, like collagen supplements and things. Like, it's not getting to your joints, you know, as soon as you digest it. There's this metabolic process that's breaking these substances down into these tiny byproducts through all these complex pathways. And it doesn't necessarily mean that if you even consume an isoflavone, that it's automatically going to be available to the right cells and the right organs at the right time. And so I think that that's super important for people to understand. And then before we get into PFAS, there's one other endocrine disruptor that I want to maybe quickly touch on, and those are intentional ones, things like hormonal contraceptions. These are intended to interfere with hormonal signaling for a clinical outcome. And there's a lot of flack about these on the TikTok. Is it the TikTok, Jess? The TikTok, I just dated myself. But there's a lot of misinformation about contraception with regard to the negative consequences or the health impact of them. And maybe, Eve, you can quickly touch on that before we get into the PFAS.
Yeah. So I start almost every clinic visit with, don't believe anything you read online about the endocrine system, and don't swallow something if you don't know what it is. I also usually include, if you're going to buy a supplement online that is, you know, advertising itself to support one of your glands, just save your money. Oh, yeah. Because somebody's benefiting and it's not.
It's going to regulate your hormones.
Right. And, you know, and I think the other thing, you know, that comes into play is like detoxing. I'm like, you know, your liver and kidneys are way better than anything you're going to swallow or take or expose yourself to. So we try and really limit exposures based on, like, you know, targeted marketing. And I really started adding that to almost every single discussion I have with my patients, because the TikTok is a very persuasive, you know, place to be. And, you know, even as an endocrinologist, it's very hard to know what's true and what's not true. And it's also very hard to quickly explain the limitations of scientific understanding and the nuances of, you know, what we do on a daily basis. And, I was looking at podcasts on endocrine disruptors. There's no way to know like what's real and what's not real. I mean, there's no fact-checking system or sort of authority. One of the resources I turn to for this is the Endocrine Society, because they have really fantastic task forces and statements and data, or, you know, evidence-based recommendations for how to manage and how to think about endocrine disruptors. But that's not really something that's available for, you know, the layperson to digest and understand. It's complicated and it's wordy. I think there's a real risk there. And, you know, sometimes I have to tell people, I'm like, take it off your phone, you know, just send me a message if you have questions about your, you know, hormones or what this is doing. But a very high level of skepticism when it comes to like claims being made on social media, or, you know, media in general, or that a friend or a parent or a sibling is sharing with you, is really critical here to not make yourself nuts.
Chris, I don't know if you're on the TikTok, but the TikTok is ablaze with lots of claims.
Most recently about the PFAS. So Chris, I want to hand it over to you. Can you tell our listeners what they are? Why are they called forever chemicals? Why is social media a buzz about PFAS?
Well, that's a complicated topic, especially with the introduction that we've just had to the endocrine system. But thank you, Eve, for that. That's very, very useful. PFAS are a collection of perhaps certainly thousands, maybe as many as 10,000 or more fluorinated carbon compounds. Now, that's the umbrella. That's the big definition. And these materials were first invented back before World War II, in about 1938. A chemist named Plunkett, who worked for DuPont, accidentally in his laboratory developed this material that was very unusual. And what he had developed was a PFAS molecule, a specific one called PFOA, or perfluorooctanoic acid. And just to break, I won't go through this with every PFAS, all 10,000 of them, but I think it's worth understanding the nomenclature a little bit. So per, in a chemistry lexicon, in chemistry language, it means every. Perfluoro, that's the fluorine atom, which really makes these molecules troublesome. But also makes them really unusual and useful for many, many purposes. Perfluorooctanoic, octa is eight, right? So octanoic acid. So there's eight carbons, all fluorinated, per, all fluorinated, octanoic eight carbon acid. So there's a molecule called a carboxylic acid on the end. And that's, so these things are named, and some of them are named in names that are very difficult to pronounce, and they're long, and there are 10,000 of them, so we won't go through all of them. But it wasn't long after these were invented that some of the workers in the DuPont plants began to complain of health effects from these. So this is not as new as many people think. And there, if you look at the history of these molecules and the development of various types of PFAS molecules, thousands of them, there's an on and off emerging realization that there were some, in some cases, very serious health effects associated with these things. So why are they, you know, why are they so popular, and why are they used? They're ubiquitous in so many parts of our lives. They're used for drilling lubricants. They're used in cosmetics because of the way they help the cosmetic spread when it's applied. They're used in packaging, that slippery stuff on the inside of your pizza box is is spread on there with various PFAS molecules. They're used in Teflon cookware. They're used to spread the Teflon on the cookware. They're not really part of the cookware intentionally. Nonetheless, some of them are around, hanging around. So when you overheat the pan, you can have a problem. And this has been the case for a long time, and still to a certain extent, if the pan gets hot enough, it's still a problem. So these molecules have made their way into our lifestyle when you put on a Gore-Tex jacket or something like that. But what's really, I think, and there are a wide variety of ways that exposure occurs, but most importantly, and I'm sure that the regulatory agencies agree with this, the most important pathway is through drinking water. And drinking water is becoming more and more scarce in our country, and taking care of it is extremely important. So the Environmental Protection Agency is working very hard, and we can talk about this in detail, over the past several years to establish a way to that was, first of all, very health conscious, and secondly, a way to implement the removal of this material from water that we're capable of doing, because they're very, very difficult to remove. These molecules are very persistent. Because of the fluorine atom, the normal degradation of carbon compounds is not possible. The fluorine prevents bacteria that normally break these things down from even reaching the carbon bond. So they're sometimes, and I don't like the nomenclature, frankly, they're referred to as forever chemicals.
Maybe we can call them 8-year chemicals.
We need a new language for sure.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, it's important to mention that the National Institutes of Health, for one, is spending millions of dollars to support chemists who are learning how to break these things down. So they're not, thanks to these smart people who are oxidizing these things and able to break them apart. Hopefully soon we'll have a method to remove them and break them down, but we're not there yet. But they're not necessarily forever chemicals. One more thing that makes these things problematic from a biological and toxicological point of view is that, or perhaps two things, they're very persistent in the body. Toxicologists, pharmacologists measure the lifetime of drugs in the body by something called a half-life. So the half-life is the time it takes to remove half the concentration from your body. These chemicals have a very, very long half-life. That makes them difficult to deal with from a toxicological point of view and from a health point of view in general. The other thing that's unusual about these carbon compounds is most fluorinated carbon compounds, or halogenated, I should say, most halogenated carbon compounds, like the pesticides, the chlorine-based pesticides, partition into fat molecules, which we all have, and therefore become less metabolically active. PFAS partitions into the serum and the blood, where it courses throughout the body. So your body is... The material is very persistent, but it also remains circulating throughout your body, which is problematic, and it makes the toxicological evaluation of what's going on very, very complex in the body. There's so many organ systems that are affected. Eve just went through the endocrine system. So when you take this, you know, the number of organs and tissues bathed in these molecules, and you couple it with the complexities of the endocrine system, piecing apart what's going on and trying to mitigate and eliminate the health effects becomes very, very difficult.
Obviously, this sounds daunting to people, right? But you mentioned, Chris, that there are thousands of these PFAS, right? So, you know, are we
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Worried about all of them? Are we worried about certain ones? You know, what's kind of the takeaway for the everyday person when they're trying to navigate a world where, at least at this point, they're ubiquitous, at least some of them are, and there aren't super effective ways to kind of biodegrade them?
So that's a really important point, Andrea. Not all 10,000 PFAS are out there in our environment, thank goodness, but they're not. There are a wide variety of PFAS in the environment, and the environment is dominated by a relatively few number, about somewhere between 5 and 15 of these things are regularly found. The United States Geological Survey just finished a comprehensive survey of water quality water systems and private wells throughout the country. They took about 716 samples or something like that. And they found about 9 PFAS that are in water. And in some cases, not in all cases, but in far and away most cases, these were in extremely low concentrations. And there are exceptions to that in areas where the material has been manufactured, manufacturing plants, where it's been disposed of in landfills. But nonetheless, we're not right now having to deal with all 10,000 PFAS or however many there are. Thank goodness.
That's reassuring. And to that study, the U.S. Geological Survey study, I think, you know, that was something that we even consulted you when we did that post, because the media kind of exaggerated the findings, and they were suggesting that 45% of drinking water, both private and public, was contaminated with toxic levels. And I think the point you make, first of all, of the sites that it was PFAS were detected, and specifically two were kind of the ones of most interest, the PFOA that you noted, Chris, and also another one called PFOS. Only about 6.7% of sites had levels exceeding those new EPA thresholds that you noted for PFOA, and only 4.2% of sites had levels of PFOS that exceeded. So 70% of all of those sites tested had no detectable PFAS of any of the ones that were tested. So I think, yes, PFAS are a concern. It is certainly has health implications, but it's maybe not as dire as media headlines are making it sound.
That's right. That's right, Andrea. And, you know, the media said half of, I think they used the term half of the water systems are contaminated. The 45% that USGS indicated may be affected was a model. They observed PFAS, including those well below the EPA's recent proposed exposure limit. There were 30% of the samples that they observed out of the 716. Now, they used a model to predict, because not all the quantitation limits for the measurement were the same. So they go up and down. So they used a model for that. But this is where, you know, the media, thank goodness for the media, but they can get it. It's easy to get it wrong, right? You can get it wrong. So what should have been said is they modeled that their contamination. They made a prediction.
And even those levels are not necessarily levels that would pose a health impact.
Right. Now, you know, the toxicology of PFAS is evolving as we speak. And EPA in March of this year proposed for the first, right now, it's important to mention to your audience that PFAS is not regulated. There are no enforcement tools that the federal government has to regulate PFAS. So, but EPA in March this year proposed an approach, which I think was very, very well put together, very well thought out. They consulted with their science advisory board and independent groups of scientists to sort of vet the proposal. And they will be, they have proposed regulatory values for six PFAS that are the most, what they perceive as the most problematic right now. And that will change. EPA is not going to give up with those six. They'll keep investigating and conducting research. But I would encourage your audience and anyone else to look and see what that proposal is and make a comment to EPA. I'm not sure the comment period is still open, but it doesn't hurt to let them know what you think. I don't know that it's necessary to go through what that proposal is right now, but once again, the two legacy PFAS that you mentioned, PFOA and PFOS, they have solid what are called maximum contaminant level. It's a proposed maximum contaminant levels. And that means that EPA will be able to require public distribution systems to meet those levels. EPA also generates what are called MCLGs, or maximum contaminant level goals. And for any carcinogenic chemical, that goal is always zero. So EPA's goal is to get it completely out of water. Sometimes it's possible to do that. Sometimes it's just not possible to do that. But so each of these six chemicals will ultimately have an MCL, an approach to regulating those chemicals, both individually for PFOA and PFOS, and as a group for the other chemicals that they will be proposing.
One of the things to emphasize is, you know, that there are, I guess, a few things. Number one is there are times that there is no minimum like level of exposure that's safe. And I think understanding that in terms of hormone actions and endocrinology is really key. And we may or may not have the ability to measure these levels in a way that we can interpret clinically. So the way that I look at it is, how do we figure out who are the vulnerable populations, and how do we look through a protective and equitable lens to make sure that we're protecting everybody and that we're providing people with actionable advice, but really that we're taking it back a step onto a more of a public regulations and, you know, policy level. Because the idea of like telling, you know, pregnant women to like avoid X, Y, and Z, you know, and to follow strict diets and strict exposure risks and to pay for very expensive glass bottles or, you know, not to microwave their food doesn't sit well with many of us for obvious reasons, and is also not going to be as impactful as things like, you know, making sure we don't have food deserts, making sure there's affordable, you know, things, there's affordable options for healthcare, there's access to healthcare. I mean, there's so many bigger fish to fry that I think the idea of this being an individual responsibility to take action and ownership over this, like for yourself, is really not the right place to like put this responsibility. You know, like there are things like eating a healthy diet and exercising that very well will mitigate a lot of the risk that we're seeing. And so really emphasizing like what we can all do while working on the policy side of things to be sure that, you know, we're not putting chemicals into the ground or like contamination areas that are going to affect future generations. I mean, I think things that keep me awake at night, I would say like climate change, you know, like access to like healthcare, gun violence, you know, racism, equity, like those things are like, you know, that I lose sleep over. I occasionally will microwave something in plastic and I don't think twice about it. Yeah. Right. And so
I do too. Yeah. And that's a great point, because like a lot of the outcry, at least on our social media channels, are people that are coming from a place of great privilege. Yes. Right. And they've got this indignation about something that they saw on social media. And I think it's super important to think about like the context, you know, and maybe this is a topic for another episode, but you know, Chris is obviously an expert in Superfund sites, and those are sites that have historically had had large amounts of chemical contamination and are no longer suitable for living or residing nearby. And we know that many marginalized low-income communities are often situated close to Superfund sites, whereas people of higher socioeconomic status, you know, are protected against that.
So it's like, good for you, Karen, that you can afford your fancy glass, cosmetics, whatever it is. Exactly. All right. So, I mean, Eve, you kind of read my mind. I think a lot of people, there's a lot of anxiety around this topic, a lot of health anxiety in general. So we get this question a lot. You know, we've even acknowledged in this episode that people are exposed to PFAS in water. We know that they could be found in cosmetics. There are other sources, right, of potential exposure. So people are very concerned about this, the bioaccumulation of the, you know, the cumulative effect. If we're exposed to these things all the time and in lots of different ways, you know, how nervous should we be? Should we be worried about bioaccumulation? And are there tangible ways to reduce our potential exposure?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's there's a combination of answers here. Number one is we can only move one way in time right now. And so, you know, if you can't go backwards in time, then there's a lot of fear and anxiety that doesn't actually allow you to like do anything about it. And a big part of me will recommend, like, you know what, there's nothing we can do about the past. What can we do now to keep you healthy? If you're taking care of yourself, if you're exercising, if you're going to see your doctor, if you can get access to healthcare, you know, there's not going to be an exposure from 30 years ago that is causing like that's causing something that's really going to be clinically meaningful that we can't find any evidence of, and that you're going to have to go to like alternative testing and go into the weeds and like let it consume you. You know, I think a certain amount of restoring trust in the health system and in understanding how we identify disease versus, you know, normalcy versus, you know, yeah, things happen and it's okay that it's no big deal, or like, let's just move forward from this. I think it's a hard balance. And I think, you know, for example, like people are super worried about their water, but like aren't worried about, you know, COVID-19 or don't get their vaccines to prevent, you know, illnesses that like will cause death. Like there's got to be some sort of like comparison and really a pragmatic approach to how you worry about your own health. And I think, you know, again, goes back to like not putting the responsibility on individuals to be able to sort through this information, but making sure things like, you know, lead exposure or things like DES or, you know, other things that we have historical references for, like that is happening at a much bigger level, I think is really the key here. You know, the other thing is listening to the community when something's going on, you know, like, for example, you know, when there are higher incidences of cancer or when you're seeing, you know, more like congenital malformations, if you are asking questions about like, you know, triple negative breast cancer in African-American communities, and then you're, you know, maybe the right next question is what are they exposed to that others aren't, you know, and so that goes into like the makeup cosmetic industry. But, you know, there are things like wear your seatbelt, like exercise, don't smoke, that are much more important, you know, get health screenings. And I try and really kind of flip the perspective so that people to allow people to not spend so much time stressing about this. And sometimes I'll use personal examples, like, you know, again, like the microwave, or, you know, I don't follow any sort of like really hard and fast rules to avoid exposure, but I did when I was pregnant, right? So like, there are also like when to focus, how do we empower certain communities at certain times that are higher risk, and how do we, you know, how do we make it as easy as possible for people to stay well? A lot of this is public health, science, communication, policy, and is not, you know, individual TikTok doing your own research. And I think there's a lot to be said to like forgive, like don't take this on yourself, you know, and don't like, the world's not missing something. And if we are, there are like a lot of people acting in alignment to try and figure that out.
Working on that. Yeah, that's a huge, hugely important. You know, I love that perspective. And as Chris mentioned, right, EPA is on the case, right? They're working on this. Maybe, Chris, you can comment kind of in light of, or in, you know, in the, as we wait for those regulations to be approved and implemented, if people, you know, want to try and mitigate their own personal exposure, what would be some easy, low stress ways that they could do that?
Well, I like what Eve said about community. There's a lot that can be done. Small personal actions. You know, when am I in a high exposure situation? When am I not? And going back to the topic of water exposure, which is probably one of the most important exposure routes that we have. I recently moved, a couple of years ago now, but one of the first things I did was call the water plant and ask, could you provide the information that you collect on a monthly or quarterly basis regarding what's in my water? And they do, they have that. And they're part of the community. We are, you know, as divided as we sometimes seem, we live in a community. It used to be, 500 years ago, there was only one water pump and you went and got your water from the water and you knew what was in that well. You know, when somebody's cow passed away next to the well, it was a problem. Well, we can still do that. You can still play a role as a member of the community and find out what is in your water. And I get in trouble all the time for this, but when I go and buy fish at the market, at the grocery store, I ask the person behind the counter, where did the fish come from? I want to know. And it's good to find out what the source of your food is. 100 years ago, we all knew because it grew in the backyard, right? But now it doesn't, but you can still find out. That's one thing. I know FDA is working very, very hard to get PFAS and many other contaminants like asbestos out of cosmetics. So I had the opportunity to work with them on some of that. And hopefully that will happen over the course of months or years. FDA will acquire the ability to regulate the amount of PFAS in cosmetics. That seems to me to be a reasonably high exposure source. So if you think about that, and use cosmetics sparingly, or ask the question. Call your cosmetic vendor and ask, is there PFAS in this? Public opinion and public pressure really is an essential part of this. Agreed, Eve, that it's not necessarily our personal responsibility to regulate water that comes out of the tap, but asking the questions about it is really a strong and very powerful way to make change.
I 100% agree with that. And then I think there's a responsible media, and making sure that we're, that we are not overblowing a situation when there's no alternative either, right? And so, when we have a question of whether, a specific type of makeup is like impacting your, great-grandchildren's ovarian function, like, yes, but also not on the news and as a headline, because it's not helpful. And it may actually have downstream consequences when you start avoiding things that are really critical for health and wellness and longevity and all of these things, and I think we just need to be careful about the impact of these kind of poorly understood, but very fear-mongering statements that go out, because yes, we can't expect everyone to understand like the complicated nuances of intracellular signaling. But we can't tell people not to eat certain foods or drink certain things if there's no alternative. And, if it's only if you have the privilege or the financials or the access to certain things. And so, a sort of social responsibility when it comes to like information sharing is, obviously that applies to everything that we talk about on a daily basis, but I think a better language and then a more structured ability to raise concerns in the community, and I think making sure that scientists are in direct communication with community leaders, when it comes to concerns and questions, even if it's to distill misinformation or if it's to listen to the community, because they're going to know, like the community knows before somebody high up knows. And, going to TikTok is going to happen. There's not much we can do about it, but also going through avenues, where that can impact change and, having these independent scientists and, facilities and independent, think tanks and that will take you seriously in making sure everyone knows how to bring their concerns to the table, I think is like the piece that tends to be missing in a lot of these conversations. And, you know, and then just going back to like, it's all nuanced. So there's like, things aren't good or bad, right? You know, there is a, there's a thousand steps in between that. And I think we don't have to cast a value. Like, chemicals aren't bad. Like, natural is not good. Like, they're words that carry a lot more information, and like the appeal to nature fallacy. Like, I see so much harm being done from people swallowing things that are like natural that, you know, I think there's, you know, I think there's a lot of, there's a lot of work that we need to do in this.
That asbestos is natural, right? You know?
Right. I mean,
right.
So many things.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, Eve, it really underscores like, you know, the endocrine system is super complex. There's redundancies, there's regulatory processes, our immune system is complex. And you know, a lot of people that promote misinformation, whether it's the media or people on social media, you know, they often co-op these limited pieces of evidence or evidence that is not causal. It's correlative. It's not parsing out variables that may confound the observations. And so that's why it's really important for scientists, clinicians, you know, all of these organizations and entities to work together because, you know, as you said, there are bigger fish to fry. There are these sorts of, you know, topics related to endocrine function are very important, but if you're not doing the other things to have access to food and good quality sleep and preventive healthcare, you know, in the grand scheme of things, avoiding, you know, cosmetics is probably lower on the hierarchy of things that we can do for overall health. So I think, you know, framing it in that way can really help to alleviate a lot of the anxiety that many people encounter.
And we need to stay humble. We also don't have all the answers. So I think it's a,
absolutely,
it's an understanding that like, to the best of our ability, we try and separate forests from trees and making sure that like, we're, you know, at least aligning with the benefit of those who we're trying to help, with the understanding that like, we might not, our whole system of understanding causality is going to be different when it comes to low level exposures over very long periods of time than, you know, when it comes to like poison equals bad or, you know, a measurable outcome in the moment. And that's how kind of like our, you know, our systems were designed in terms of harm. And so, you know, I think we have a ways to go in restoring trust and also in communicating, and, you know, I always come back to that. But from my standpoint, I don't get on a soapbox and say, this doesn't matter. And I think that's really key because it may matter. I think it's really about, you know, trying to help people kind of be more pragmatic about it and to alleviate some of the fears and also to take away some of the self-blame and, you know, and issues that are much bigger than that individual. And, you know, I think that like, as long as we have equitable and, you know, equitable solutions that, are accessible and that are navigated on a much higher level, we can at least keep our North Star moving in the right direction.
That's a great point. And, you know, to that point, you know, and Chris, I'm going to hand it over to you for any kind of last thoughts before we wrap, but, you know, there are new regulatory frameworks in multiple agencies. There are new research models that are being developed to better understand and parse out confounding variables and identify cause versus effect of these types of exposures that are very complicated and interacting with a very complicated physiological system so that we really can expand the knowledge and navigate these sorts of topics better collectively. So, you know, hopefully I think the listeners have kind of walked away with, you know, yes, there are things that you should be aware of, but maybe you don't need to be as paralyzed with fear, that the endocrine system is pretty remarkable at balancing itself, even if you are exposed to certain things.
Or treating it if it's not right.
Exactly. Or treating it. And you don't have to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I know Jess loves that phrase. Chris, any last thoughts from a toxicological perspective, you know, about PFAS or anything like that before we wrap?
You know, I had the privilege over the last 12 years of working with NIH, for NIH, on the NIH campus in Bethesda. And there is an army. There's over 17,000 employees on that campus, not counting those that are not on the campus. And they're working really hard on understanding what's going on, not just with PFAS, but extensively with PFAS. And lots of emerging science. Toxicology is on. It's about to change radically in the coming years and decades as we begin to employ robotics, high throughput screening. Just north of me here in Bethesda, there is a team of robots who 24 hours a day, 7 days a week run assays to test the biochemistry and toxicology of various mixtures and individual substances. They can run thousands of samples a day, and they run every day, and all the amount of information coming from that is just tremendous. So this to say, there's a lot going on. We haven't heard the last from the Environmental Protection Agency on their efforts to continue to make sure that we have clean water. But, you know, by the way, it's, you know, without a doubt, the United States has some of the cleanest water in the world, an important thing to remember as we, you know, as we, and it's good that we remain concerned about how, the quality and keep improving it. But, you know, remember that we are pretty much at the top of the heap when it comes to being able to deliver clean water to almost our entire population. There are exceptions, of course, but so I'm looking forward to further information on the topic, continued work on these complex problems. I think that we're well underway. Once EPA establishes these maximum contaminant levels, we're going to see a tremendous drop in exposure. So that's all very bright things on the future. New tools, you know, strong regulatory efforts underway, and it's looking up.
Ending on an optimistic note. We love that, Chris.
I love that, yeah.
Eve, Chris, thank you so much for joining us. This was such a comprehensive and necessary conversation. Obviously, we really only scratched the surface. There's so much more we could say.
Right.
We had to go here because people had a lot of questions. And Chris, as you said, you know, we'll learn more, our knowledge will evolve, and we'll continue to share.
I learned so much from Chris and from you guys about this. So this was wonderful.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks very much for having us.
Absolutely. Thank you both. I think it gave everyone a very comprehensive, high-level overview. Of course, there are tons of data, but go to the credible sources. Don't go to the TikTok. Thank you again, Dr. Chris Weiss and Dr. Eve Bloomgarden, for joining us. Listeners, we hope you learned a thing or two. And if you want to support our efforts and help grow the impact and reach of Unbiased Science, we welcome your contributions. We have a donation page on our website, a Venmo, and a Ko-fi account. We also have some fun, snarky science merch, including Science is Sexy and Your Anecdote is Not Evidence. And you can pick those up on our website at www.unbiasedscipod.com. Make sure, of course, to subscribe to our YouTube, which is YouTube at UnbiasedSciPod, and all of our social media accounts, same handle at UnbiasedSciPod. Catch you next time on the pod, your trusted source for no nonsense, just science.
I am a scientist.